How do we understand God? We say, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, Almighty, in the Apostles' Creed. Almighty, and when we were in confirmation class, we learned all the omnis, right? Remember them? Omnipotent, omniscient, question mark. What's that? Fourth one is giving away and a way. Too clever, really. And number five, gratitude, attitude, the attitude of gratitude, attitude for life. That's our program for the week. So this one will be on Thursday, this one on Friday, and this one Saturday morning. Somebody asked me yesterday if in talking about grief, today we were going to talk only about suicide grief, because I mentioned yesterday that my interest in getting into this discussion comes from the fact that I am a suicide survivor, meaning that I am a person left behind after someone succeeded in killing herself, himself. In my case, it was my wife almost 20 years ago, my wife Helen. We're not going to concentrate only on suicide grief, but I am going to say some things about suicide grief as we move along through the hour, because I believe that suicide grief, while it participates in much of what, how do we say it, the general grief experience participates in, yet in some very important respects, suicide provokes in people a different kind of experience. And that's that distinction I would like to make as we move along. But I would like to know if, and you don't need to do a show of hands necessarily, but if there are those who would like to have some time together to think more specifically about suicide, I would be very glad. In fact, I'd be thrilled to find an hour today, tomorrow, next day, when we could do that. This is something that I care very, very deeply about. And if there are people in the room who are suicide survivors, or maybe are people who have at some time in life been suicidal, or know people who are suicidal and know people that you're worried about because you're afraid they might be suicidal, any of that kind of discussion, I don't set myself up as an expert on suicide. I don't think there are experts. Only the people who have died by suicide are experts on suicide, and they're not here to tell us about it. But I have read a lot of books, and as I told you yesterday, I spent 10 years with a support group, twice a month, listening to literally hundreds and hundreds of suicide families, people where a loved one had died by suicide. And they have been my teachers. That has been listening to the sacred for me, to use the title of this summer at Holden. And if I could be helpful to folks that are concerned about suicide, in whatever way, let's find a time to do that. Just out of interest, how many of you are suicide survivors or would claim that term? A few of you are. It's surprising how many folks have had a relative or maybe a roommate. My parish was in the middle of the university. I've spent all my life in college, never graduated. How many students would come whose roommate had died by suicide, or a girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, some gay partners, love relationships among gays or lesbians, who would come to our support group. Anyone who saw himself or herself as a suicide survivor. And as I mentioned last time, it's nothing short of miraculous the way in which people are helped by that simple device of just being supportive of one another in an atmosphere where they can feel lots of permission to be very frank, very candid, very open. And we used to advertise, we do now still advertise, that there are no professionals in this group. There are no psychotherapists in this group. And I've had people say they're very glad there are no psychotherapists around because they don't want anybody saying, oh, what you're really saying is, you know. Now, everybody comes in the trade, it's called a leaderless support group. And the facilitator is one of the members of the group, doing a very modest, simple job. Later in the week, under the title of giving, I'd like to say more about how I think congregations could use support groups as a medium for ministry. It's so easy. It's such a modest thing. And yet there are countless human hurts that can be served by groups of that kind. And as you know, there are many, many support groups in every major city on virtually anything you can mention. Someone yesterday told me that a relative, a sister, had been murdered. And I know in the Twin Cities there's a support group for families of persons who have died by being murdered. That may seem like a very small population, but we'd be surprised at how many people have had to go through that dreadful experience. And there's another overlay in the grief experience for that family, given the violence of that death. Well, that was what I wanted to say at the outset. Now, I think I'd like to say just a word about to summarize what we did yesterday. We started out with the theme, it's okay not to be okay. And I asked for some interpretations of that from you folks and got some wonderful responses. Somebody said, I changed the language a little bit. It says to me that it's okay that there are some bumps along the way, that I'm not always at my best, that I don't have to keep up with the Joneses. I don't always have to be okay. I don't always have to be perfect. I don't ever have to be perfect. And I thought the insight that we can give up the pretense of being okay. So much of the time, as several of you remarked, we cover over how we're really feeling. Why do we do that? We do it partly because we don't want to come off as broken people. And sometimes we do it to protect others, I think. I had a good friend once whose husband died, and many months later, 2 or 3 years later, she went to her home in New Jersey. And she had dealt with her husband's death in those 2 years, but she said, when I came off the airplane, all these people with their sad faces, and I had to take care of those people. Huh? And that's what so often happens, is that the grieving person has to take care of the people around him or her because they are the ones who are kind of worried about how things are going for you. And then you have to do a lot of reassuring. I am okay, you know. I'm not okay, but I am okay. Then what I tried to do was to relate this expression to the good news, the gospel. This is good theology, it seems to me, to say that it's okay not to be okay. That we are children of God despite our imperfections, morally, ethically, and we got talking doctrinally as well. I'm glad you asked that question, Ron. Actually, in looking at my notes, I had a note about that, but hadn't gotten to it. So, glad you were there. Speak up again. We talked about baptism. Is that by which we are adopted into the family of God, according to our understanding of the scriptures? Now, that's kind of a summary. Let's find out where you are. You've had almost 24 hours, and I'm sure you've thought about nothing except what we talked about that. Is there anybody who wants to make any comment or any question before we move on? You're all okay. Where did we ever get the idea, folks, that the church is for good people? Where did we ever get that idea? Isn't that a crazy notion? The church is for good people? But don't you hear that all the time? Huh?
I don't hear it, but feel it in the attitude.
Yeah. And there are a lot of young people who are very turned off by the church. I've worked with college students all my life, very turned off by the church, because they don't see the people in the church as being any different than other people are. And I often say to them, well, why should they be? The church is a very human institution, after all. It's a very human institution, made up of people. And the people are both the best and the worst that we've got in the church. I mean, after all, it's all we've got in the church, is the people. What more do we have? Well, we have the Word of God. Let's not dismiss that. But I mean, visibly in front of us, in any given congregation, what we have is human beings. And human beings make mistakes. Human beings live duplicitously, hypocritically. Do we? Huh? Do we? People who are in the church are sinful people, we say. Huh? We're broken people. We're people injured by life. We're people who are disappointed and frustrated, and our dreams have been shattered, and we have all kinds of needs that very often don't get spoken in the church, because the church is the last place that you really want to expose yourself. For lots of folks. Isn't that sad? And when you think about it, so much of preaching is telling people to shape up. Think about the word preach. What does the word preach mean to people, generally? What does the word preach mean to people? Tell them what to do, right? Remember that old song, Papa don't preach to me, preach to me, Papa don't preach to me. You're too young to remember that song. The word preaching has gotten a terrible bad name in our society. The original meaning of the word preach is to proclaim. Did you know that? To proclaim. The preacher proclaims the good news that it's okay not to be okay. That's the good news, the gospel. We call it the gospel. The word gospel in Greek is euangelion, which means happy news, good news. And the preacher is the proclaimer. Wonderful things to offer people from the Word of God. But instead, preaching so often gets to be, can't do this, can't do this, better not do this, law stuff, huh? Instead of gospel. Luther one time said that the hardest thing in all the world in preaching proclamation and in teaching is to rightly distinguish between law and gospel. He understood that there are times when the law must be used. But how to distinguish in your teaching and preaching between law and gospel is a very, very difficult problem. And any of you who have tried to preach or teach know that that's true. I have always said that I know that I will err in the distinction between law and gospel. But I choose to err on the side of gospel. My ordination certificate says that I am a minister of the gospel. It does not say, I am a minister of the law. I am a minister of the gospel. My job as a preacher and a teacher is to proclaim the good news of the love of God in Jesus Christ, that it's okay not to be okay. And if the church doesn't have that to say to people, then I don't think we have anything to say to people. We don't have anything to say that social service agencies or other service clubs or whatever in our community can't say much better than we can. That's the message that we have for people, is the love of God through Jesus Christ, that we are acceptable to God, not because we've measured up, but because of God's endless mercy and extravagant grace toward the human race, toward all of us as human beings. That's the message. Paul Tillich, do you know the name? How many know the name Paul Tillich? One of the great minds of the 20th century, grew up in Germany during the Nazi era, had to flee because he was very involved in the anti-Nazi movement. Through Reinhold Niebuhr, came to Union Seminary, was a teacher there for many years in New York, moved up to Harvard, taught at Harvard Divinity School for many years, and then ended his teaching life at the University of Chicago, where I had the great privilege of knowing Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich, in one of his sermons, if you try to read his theology, it's very tough. But read his sermons, and you'll find very, very simple evangelical preaching. Now, I want to stop with that word evangelical. Some people have taken over that word. The fundamentalists have taken over the word evangelical. I belong to the evangelical Lutheran Church in America. The word evangelical belongs to Lutherans in a very special way. Did you know that in Germany, they don't call the Protestant church the Lutheran church? Martin Luther didn't want the church named after him. They call it the evangelical church. Evangelische Kirche. Right? Yeah, right. It's the evangelical church in Germany. The church of the gospel is what it means. Evangelical means gospel. It's the adjective form of that word. Paul Tillich preached a very simple evangelical message. And in one of his sermons, he says to the congregation, now I would like to have you just sit back and think about the fact that you are accepted. You are accepted. Now don't worry, he says, about who it is that's accepting you. Don't worry about that right now. Just think to yourself, you are accepted. Though you are unacceptable. There's no doubt about that you are unacceptable. But you are accepted. Now, says Tillich, accept the acceptance of the unacceptable. I think that's wonderful. I have quoted that so many times with suicide survivors, because an important part of suicide grief is the sense of somehow having caused this death. Suicide always seems like a death that did not have to happen. We all know that death comes to us at the end of life. All of us will die. The grim reaper comes and has his way. But with suicide, it always feels like this is a suicide, this is a death that could have been prevented. And if I am Helen's husband, then I am the one who should have been able to prevent it. But she died. So I must have failed in some very profound way, because she killed herself despite the fact that she lived with this great guy, a pastor, for goodness sakes. Who's supposed to know how to deal with the ills and the hurts of people? I don't know more than two suicide survivors who have not participated in that awful sense of being somehow caught up in the death of the person who died. One of them was a woman whose daughter, 16 years old, had killed herself. And this young girl had been schizophrenic since she was very, very young, diagnosed schizophrenic. Schizophrenia is a mental illness for which, from everything I know, there really is no cure. Medications can take the edge off it, can help a person to function reasonably normally, sometimes. But this young girl had over and over and over attempted to kill herself, and she finally succeeded. And what this mother said was in our support group, "I believe that my daughter died from an incurable illness called schizophrenia." So she was able to understand her daughter's death as inevitable in the same way that death is for all of us. But that's very unusual. Usually suicide survivors have the sense that this death could have been prevented. And all the suicide prevention literature says that suicide can be prevented. Suicide prevention literature is very tough stuff to read for a suicide survivor. Because the message that comes through is that if you really understood this person, if you really loved this person, if you really cared for this person, if you really listened to this person, that death might have been prevented. Now that's a debatable question among suicidologists as to whether suicides can indeed be prevented. But generally speaking, suicide survivors feel that this suicide could have been prevented. And if it could have been prevented, then I'm the one who should have been able to help that person survive. And I failed. So how do I feel? I'm not okay. Now, let's get on to the general subject. But before we do that, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but how many of you are in grief right now? How many of you are experiencing grief? Would any of you be willing to just say a word about that? What's going on for you? Is that too embarrassing? I don't want to point you up as an individual, but if you'd like to share that with us, please.
My blood father, whom I did not meet only once in my life, did commit suicide about 6 months ago. I also was involved in a divorce, and I think I'm experiencing a little bit of grief.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else?
Well, I'm sharing mine. Mine is not a death. It's a schism in our church. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is a form of grief.
Yeah.
That to try to live with this and to deal with the pain that goes with it.
Mm-hmm. Good. Grief is a much more general experience than death grief. So you're absolutely right, it seems to me. Anybody else want to say something? Yes, please.
My husband died suddenly on a church retreat 2.5 years ago.
And you're still feeling it.
My question is, when are you not in grief?
Okay.
After you have lost your mate?
Mm-hmm.
It's been 5 years, over 5 years. And even though many days are good, but then you have those days that you go back down again.
Yeah.
And I've decided just recently that it's okay to do that. I mean, down some, up and down.
Yep. Yep. Good for you. Absolutely. And there's no timeline on grief.
No, there's no time. You know, you never know when it's going to come.
That's right.
and then you have to deal with it to make it go away again for a while, or whatever.
Yeah. I want to hear from the rest of you, but let me just say in response to this that many years ago I attended a grief seminar, day-long seminar in Minneapolis, and there were two psychiatrists who spoke in the morning, and both of them said, if the grief experience gets to be more than 12 months, it becomes pathological. Pathological means sick, of course. But I want to finish this. The lunch hour happened, and the next speaker was a man I'd never met before, but later got to know very, very well. One of the most marvelous human beings I've ever known in my life. His name is John Brantner. He teaches in the school, or he taught in the School of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. And as a campus pastor, I often brought him into student programs. One of the most life-affirming persons I've ever met. Sad to say, John Brantner killed himself about 2 years ago. I'm getting off the subject, but I'll get back. John used to say in his lectures, some people say, when I die, I don't want you to cry for me. I don't want you to mourn. I don't want to have a big funeral. John said, when I die, I want everybody to cry for me. I want everybody to be sad. I want a great big funeral. And then he'd laugh. He always said, ha 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 ha. Well, when John died, he got his wish. Everybody was sad. Huge, huge funeral. The big Episcopal Cathedral in Minneapolis was standing room only for John's funeral. Well, John was a speaker right after lunch at that grief seminar. And now, pardon me, folks, I hope you don't have tender ears, but the very first word John said when he got to the podium was, bullshit! And then he explained why he said that. He said, there is no timeline on grief. He said, whether a grief experience is a healthy experience or a pathological experience is something that we, speaking of himself in psychiatry, know almost immediately, because it's dependent not on the quantity or length of the grief experience, but on the quality of the grief experience. And the things you look for in healthy grief are openness, not hiding it, willingness to talk about it to other people, be public. That doesn't mean you tell everybody, but it does mean you tell somebody. And whether or not in the experience you're moving somewhere in that process. And you're not stuck spinning your wheels like some people get. And to stay there forever. That's what he said. And in the years intervening with all the experience I've had with suicide survivors, I would say that is absolutely correct.
One of the things that has that I assessed, feeling that I'm okay to be grieving occasionally, is that I'm having dreams about my husband. Mm-hmm. But every dream is a wonderful dream. Ah. It's something something that occurred maybe, or we go on a trip and we're doing something, and it's always younger and we're just punching love and we just go. And after I had a few of those, I thought, my goodness. And I've decided that is part of helping me through all this. And it's just wonderful. I wake up in the morning and it's just wonderful to have one.
Isn't it funny how your dreams can influence how you feel the next day?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I am.
Who else would like to say something about
it? I think one of the things that continues to come back to me because of our 17-year-old grandson, who gave no explanation, shouldn't, but I cannot avoid it, to ask the question why, but seemingly everything that had the why, without placing any guilt on myself or placing guilt on somebody else that somebody should have done something different. And that continues occasionally become my my mind is I think that it's almost 5 years.
I dare say we spend 60, 70, 80% of our time in the suicide grief support group talking about that question. And it gets framed in countless different ways. Why? Sometimes it's asked theologically, where was God when my 16-year-old blew his head off? Where was God? And that's what we want to talk about in our next session, under God, Almighty Omni. But very often it also is framed in terms simply of wondering what was going through his head. A woman whose husband drove to their cabin up in northern Minnesota, got up there and took a rifle and killed himself. And the thing that kept going through her mind over and over and over and over and over again was, what was John, that wasn't his name, what was John thinking about as he drove up that road where we've driven dozens of times, hundreds of times, with our family looking forward to a happy weekend at the cabin? Did he ever think about us? What was in his mind? And people go back over that, the weeks and months prior to the death, with a fine-tooth comb, like Sherlock Holmes with his magnifying glass, looking for clues, trying to figure out what happened. In a teenage suicide, you go and talk to the high school chums and the boyfriends, girlfriends. And the sad thing is that you never get an answer. You get some answers, but you never get the answer you're looking for. Or let me put it another way, it's sort of like a jigsaw puzzle that had 1,000 pieces, and only 600 pieces are there, and you put it together, and you got some of the picture. But very seldom do people have the kind of satisfaction with this that they would like to have. And what I believe is that it's when people can begin to let go of this question, can begin to say, well, I guess we don't need to know, that then they're beginning to move from what at first is a preoccupation with that death, that becomes the focal point. It becomes that through which you look at everything else in the world. You move away from that to being able to let go. And I like to say, life is lived in chapters. Life is not a seamless robe. Life is lived in chapters. This one, this one, this one. And we have to somehow learn how to close the door on a chapter. I don't mean slam the door. I mean lovingly and gently close the door and sort of say, okay, that was okay. And then turn around and walk into whatever tomorrow offers. And that, it seems to me, is what your dreams are doing for you. It's kind of closing that door gently, and you have some wonderful things that you bring out of that chapter into the future, beautiful things that you want to keep. And you never, really, ever want to get rid of the sadness. Does that make sense?
That's right.
I've often had people say, when do you get over it? And I've usually responded by saying, I guess it depends on what you mean by over it. If over it means that that you've forgotten it, or it's obliterated from your consciousness, then I don't think you ever get over it. I will always be a suicide survivor. I will always love Helen, my wife. I will always mourn her passing. But I don't have to feel as intensely in pain over that as I was at one time. Thank God we are relieved from the heaviness and the horror that we go through, most of us, immediately after a loss. We can move away from that, but we are always, that reality is always a part of who we are. And hey, people, I don't ever want to get rid of that. If I ever reach the point where Helen is out of my consciousness forever, I'll have turned into a rock like that. And it's so wonderful. When I've gone to California to visit in the wintertime, I drive past the house we lived in, the house that Helen died in, and I drive through the neighborhood, and I remember some of those things, and I am deeply, deeply sad and deeply, deeply lonely. And part of what, this may sound really strange, but part of what I grieve is that my little boys aren't around anymore. It's not just Helen's death, but my little boys are men now. And that whole era of my life, which was so wonderful, being dad to these two great kids, is gone. And that's a grief experience in and of itself. But there's some, that's kind of a reminder that I'm still human. I'm still flesh and blood. I still have feelings that are important. There are values that I carry with me for the rest of my life. And I will never be the same as I was before all that happened.
I've heard a lot of people say they're afraid to let go of that intense grief or feel they'll forget the person. Mm-hmm. And so they hang on to that grief because that's their way of hanging on to them.
I've heard people say that as time passes, they feel sadder, really, because they feel like they're getting farther away from the person who died. And I think that's a very human experience. I mean, that's part of it. That's okay. See, I think grieving people need to be given permission to act out their grief however they want to. So much of the time, we take that away from them. The day my wife died, I had taken my boys to, I'd gone to play to watch my boys play soccer. They were on separate teams, and I went to watch Brian, my younger son, play his game. They won the game, and then Brian and his teammate went home, and that's when Brian found his mother's body, I told you yesterday. Then I went over to watch my older son's game, and they won their game too. And as the game was ending, there was a house in the neighborhood that was on fire, and the fire trucks came. Dana on his bicycle and I went over and watched the fire with all the crowd gawking at this fire, like people do. And while we were standing there watching the fire, the paramedic truck tore out of there with its tires screeching and the siren going. Do you know where they were going? To my house. I didn't know that at the time, of course. And then Dana went home on his bicycle, and I went to the grocery store and shopped, as I always did. Met a friend in the parking lot, and we were standing out in beautiful weather like today, Palo Alto, California, and talked. Got in my car, and I drove toward the house, and here my house was surrounded by emergency vehicles with the lights going. My heart went into my stomach. I knew immediately what had happened. I parked in front. Our pastor came out the door of the house and said very simply, "Helen is dead." And I lost it. And I just lost it. And I came in the room, and Helen's body was lying wrapped in a sheet on a stretcher. And I wanted to tear that sheet away, and I wanted to throw myself on her body and hold her. And a policeman grabbed me by the bicep I still feel his clutch on my arm. And he said, "You don't want to do that." And he pulled me back. I told the Bloomington police when I was invited to come and talk to them about suicide. And they were not very happy when I said this. I said, "I resent that cop to this day. He had no right to tell me what I wanted to do. He had no right to tell me how I should behave in that moment. I had every right to embrace my wife's body if I wanted to." And we get all nervous. Whoa, they must be going nuts. And in the hospital scene, they bring a hypodermic needle and they quiet you down, right? Huh? Isn't that what we do? We take their grief experience away from them. And I believe, and this is tough, folks, this is not easy when it happens, I believe that the grieving person ought to be allowed to act out that experience however they want to. Parentheses, short of killing themselves, I guess. But let the person do what they need to do for that moment. If it's scream or holler or whatever. In a hospital situation, it's sometimes tough. I remember when an elderly man was killed and the daughter was there and she yelled up and down the corridors. She was so angry because a couple of kids had killed her dad, she felt, with a car. And you know, hospital decorum won't allow that. So there are problems with this. But as a principle, people need to have opportunity to express their grief however they must and want to, I think. Now, anybody want to argue with me? Medical people, psychiatrists, psychologists, whoever you are. I really think that's important. How would you describe grief? What's it like? What's there?
Emptiness.
I'm going to put some of this up here. Emptiness.
Pain.
Loneliness.
Out of control.
Longing. Reminiscing.
I never know how to spell that word, so I'll say remembering.
I felt like somebody who started cannon not through knowing me. You could see daylight through the avenues.
Physical pain.
Oh, sure.
Physical pain, too, yes. That's physical as well as emotional, for sure. I don't quite know how to put what you said in one word. Blown apart, yeah. Fragmented.
Yeah.
Out of control, maybe says the same thing, I don't know. No.
I felt more like a basketball in your stomach.
I'm sorry.
Your basketball in your stomach. You have a funny feeling in your stomach.
Oh, you feel like you're 9 months pregnant. I don't know what that feels like. Great, big, heavy
doesn't
weight.
Doesn't feel like that.
Oh, it doesn't?
No, it doesn't.
Well, you know what that's like.
She does.
I spoke too soon. I don't know what that's like. Okay, the great big basketball. Let's just put basketball.
If the pregnancy's in your stomach, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because you don't feel like you. It's almost an out-of-body experience sometimes.
Yeah. You said
anger
more than
at
this,
God.
But sort of. Not yourself. Pardon me?
Anger at God.
Anger at God. And very often anger at the person who died. And we're not talking about head, we're talking about gut stuff here. This is gut stuff.
I think the opposite of out of control, just fighting for control.
Okay.
And maybe that's because the world is telling you must get into control, you must stop crying, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, because they can't handle your tears.
Yeah.
So so the rest of the people, they don't know what to do. So if you just stop crying, they don't have to deal with what to do.
Oh, that's right.
So I think it's a fighting for control.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else?
Also, you don't believe it.
Just the denial.
Denial, right.
At first, when you go anywhere, you just know people can tell by looking at you that you're not.
Mm-hmm. Sort of feel like you have a sign on yourself. I'm grieving. Look out. Lights blinking.
I'm not sure that wasn't better in the old days when they would wear what special clothes when they were grieving or something, than if the people do know you're grieving. I think the hard part is people don't know you're grieving, and then they can't accept your behavior.
Mm-hmm. There was an advantage to that black armband and black hood. I'm going to put guilt up here. You ever feel that? Why do people buy these expensive caskets for grandmas when she dies? Fear. I'm going to put fear up here. People talk about waking up in the morning just scared. They don't know what they're afraid of. Scared, just scared. In suicide, families are often afraid that there's going to be another suicide. At least they're able to identify what it is they're afraid of. Sometimes you can't even identify it.
When I was 4 years old, my mother died, and they didn't tell me that she died. They said that she'd gone away somewhere she was happy. So I think betrayed to a child.
Yeah. Children, that's... That's not very good counsel for Jesus.
She's gone to be with the angels.
Yeah. Everything I've read about childhood grief, and I don't know a lot about that. As I said yesterday, our support group has not done a very good job with children, or with kids, even teenagers. But everything I've learned about childhood grief says that we need to be more honest with kids than we generally are.
I have a beautiful example of that. My brother died very suddenly last year, and when his daughter told the granddaughter, "We're on our way to see Dad," she knew that they were on their way. She said, "Now I do not know how we may find Dad, Granddaddy. Granddaddy may still be living, and Granddaddy will not be living." And the granddaughter said, "That's okay. If God wants to take Grandpa, it's all right. But boy, it's going to be hard on me." And that was her answer. And we have kept that before us. It's okay if God takes her, but it's hard on me.
There's a little book on grief that almost all Lutheran people have read, I suppose. Granger Westberg published this many, many years ago, and it's been published in all kinds of different formats, called Good Grief, Granger Westberg. And he talks about the stages of the grief experience. All due regard to Granger Westberg, I don't like the term stages, because it gives the impression that you move from one to one to night to night to talk to talk. We had a woman in our group one night who said, "I was at stage 5, and now I'm back at stage 1. I must be losing my mind." And she honestly believed that. She honestly had the notion that she was supposed to move through these stages in some kind of orderly fashion. The truth is that all of these feelings that you folks have talked about, it'd be better not to list them at all, but just write them on top of each other. Sometimes on blackboards, I've just written these things all over the place. That's what grief is like. They come clashing in on your psyche, uninvited, and from nowhere. And grief is the most untidy of all human experiences. What the grief writers are doing is analyzing the experience, and there's an advantage in doing it. It's a good idea to analyze it. But analyzing the experience and living the experience are two very, very different things. This out of control, this disorientation that intensely grieving people have, it comes out of this sense that it's all going on at the same time. And there's no orderliness about it whatsoever. Now, when I say that, of course, I'm talking about intense grief. And there are different gradations here. We all understand that. A death that happens very abruptly, without any preparation whatsoever, is obviously going to leave behind it a more intense grief experience than someone who's died over a long period of time. If Helen had died when she made her first suicide attempt, and I didn't know there was anything wrong with her, I told you yesterday that I'd come home and nothing had happened, I'd get angry, but I didn't think of her as sick. When she went into the hospital and was in a coma for 40 hours, and all night the doctor would come out and tell me, "We think we can save her, but we don't know," I was going nuts. And if she had died that night, I might have lost my mind. That's how I feel. But I had 4.5 years of, forgive me, dress rehearsal. And by the time Helen died, it was dreadful. But it wasn't nearly as terrible as it would have been if she died that first night. The books talk about anticipatory grief. We go through an experience of expectation of that loss when we know that that death is inevitable. A person who has cancer, my brother lost his wife 3 years ago this fall, after many years of cancer, and they knew she was dying. They prepared for her death, her funeral, everything was written up. He had time to work through that before her death. And then, of course, an irretrievable loss leaves people more intensely in grief than a loss that can be recovered. If you move away and you lose your friends, you can get another set of friends. I don't mean to take away from the sadness of that, it can be awful. Your best friend leaves town, moves away. That happened, incidentally, just before Helen made her first suicide attempt. Her best friend left town. And I think that contributed to her depression. Helen always needed a best friend. Everywhere we lived, she had a best friend. I never had a best friend, but Helen had a best friend, and it was important to her. And she moved away. That was very hard for her to take. 6 months later, she tried to kill herself. That's not the only thing that contributed, obviously, but I think it contributed.
Having worked at a cemetery, I can almost tell a story for every one of these types of grieving.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was there 20 years, and I'm just sitting there thinking about how some of them reacted.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's pretty awful, isn't it? I think it's important for us to understand that as dreadful as the grief experience is, it is a healing process. People feel like they're going crazy many times. And I've tried to reassure folks sometimes to realize that what you're going through is a healing process. It's like if you've broken a leg, you put a cast on your leg. And after a while, you learn to hate that cast. You can't take a decent shower, you know. It itches in there. After a while, it starts to get smelly. And the thing you want more than anything else is to take a hatchet and just break that blooming thing, get rid of it. And that's how grief is. You really want to get rid of it. You really want to get over it because it's just too painful. But we always need to stop and think about what's going on inside of that cast. Something good is happening inside that cast. And if we just keep the cast on there, be patient. I believe that grief is an experience that requires so much patience, almost inhuman patience. Patience with ourselves and patience with one another. You know, families can break up over grief. You know that. Many times sudden death of a child, sudden death syndrome, you're familiar with that, will lead to a divorce. Now, why does that happen? People in a family begin to blame each other for the way they're grieving, or they're not grieving. You don't cry anymore. You must not have loved my daughter, our daughter, as much as I do. And the old guy is saying, how come you're crying all the time? Aren't you over it yet? Huh? And they blame each other. And with suicide death, it often happens that they also are blaming each other at another level. They're blaming each other for the fact that the death happened in the first place. So we need to be very, very patient with each other. We would normally think that a tragedy would draw a family together. But invariably it works exactly the opposite. It's like a grenade going off in the living room. It just poof and people bleed. And it's like all your feeling antennae are hanging out somewhere and you rub against each other and you're abrasive to each other in a way that normally is not the case. Everybody is so hypersensitive in a grief situation. We need to be very aware of that when we work with people in grief, congregations, pastors, working with families, and for ourselves, and to try to find the patience to live through that experience. And sometimes it's very, very hard.